From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In a summer so far of policy wins, President Obama appears to be feeling pretty good. The big Iran deal, high court backing on same-sex marriage, Obamacare, fast-track authority on trade, Cuba, right alongside the clock ticking down on his presidency. No drama Obama is getting dramatic, looser, more outspoken, freewheeling on prison, on race and grace and Iran. Last night with Jon Stewart on the media. This hour on Point, full drama Obama in the last chapter of his presidency. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you glad the president, this president, is dumping the mute button? What do you want to hear him say or not say? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at the unnerving roadside arrest tapes, dash cam of Sandra Bland, the Chicago woman pulled over in Texas and later found dead in her jail cell. But first, the president lets it rip. The iconic moment right here last month when President Obama traveled to Charleston, South Carolina, to deliver the eulogy for Reverend Clementa Pinckney and eight other members of the Emmanuel AME Church there. Late in his address, he paused, looked down, and then began to sing from the heart, Amazing Grace.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved
President there in Charleston, and the whole big hall joined in. There is something new going on with Mr. Cool, President Barack Obama. Let's look at it. Joining me now from Washington is Glenn Thrush, chief political correspondent for Politico. His latest piece is headlined Meet Drama Obama. He's host of Politico's new podcast, Off Message. Glenn Rush, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be here.
From Mobile, Alabama, Cynthia Tucker Haynes joins us, columnist formerly for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, won the 2007 Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Cynthia Tucker Haynes, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
And from Washington, Michael Warren joins us, staff writer for the Weekly Standard, where they keep a fairly skeptical eye on the president. Michael, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
There was more last night. Barack Obama on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Jon Stewart's headed off that show. Maybe the last time they talk there. Stewart asked Obama how he feels about his recent wins.
It appears that you're feeling it a little bit right now. You've got this deal with Iran worked out. You've got your fast-track authority. Are you feeling like 7 years in, whatever?
I finally know what I'm doing.
I'm figuring this thing out. I'm figuring this thing out. Is that how you're...
I tell you, there's no doubt that you get better as you go along. It's like any other job. And you get more experience. But what I do think has happened is that a lot of the work that we did early starts bearing fruit.
And that's a calm, low-key way of putting it. It's been put in higher key and often lately. Glenn Thrush with Politico in Washington. Your headline is Meet Drama Obama. What's going on here? Was the president really corked up tight all these years and now he's suddenly letting loose? How do you read it?
Well, I think he did a pretty good job in explaining him sort of figuring out the instrumentalities of the presidency. Look, you know, during the first term, particularly on issues of race, he allowed his then Attorney General Eric Holder to take the lead on a lot of these things and really allowed Holder to take a wider role on those issues because he was concerned about being reelected. And in terms of the 2012 campaign, he wanted to appeal to an obviously larger segment of the electorate. Freed up from the responsibility of having to run again, he's clearly starting to articulate issues that are closer to his heart. But I also sense something else that's going on here. You can already make the argument that he's had one of the most successful second terms of any modern president. I think that's indisputable. And really, a lot of that, as you articulated, went down in the last couple of months. There is a sense of... I wouldn't say desperation, but there is a sense of fierce urgency that Obama has to get as much done as possible. You know, the Iran arms deal, not something that's particularly close to his heart, but it was the major unaddressed foreign policy initiative of his administration. I think a good question now is, what else does he have on his bucket list?
There was a time when the president seemed so cool, so deliberately cool and buttoned up that Key and Peele would bring in their anger translator to lay out what he actually meant. Here's a little bit from 2012 Comedy Central sketch show. Jonathan Peele plays Obama. Keegan-Michael Key plays Obama's anger translator, Luther. You'll hear Peele's Obama first.
I just want to say to my critics, I hear your voices, and I'm aware of your concerns.
So maybe if you could chill the hell out for like a second, then maybe I can focus on some, you know?
That goes for everybody, including members of the Tea Party.
Oh, don't even get me started on me right here.
I want to assure you that we will be looking for new compromises with the GOP in the months ahead.
And you know I'll say no before I even suggest it.
Cynthia Tucker Haynes, is the anger translator been fired? No need. Obama's got his own candor going on now.
It is absolutely clear, Tom, that he can be a lot more free with what he's feeling, expressing his emotions than he felt he could be in his first 6 years. And I think that there were reasons why he felt the need to be so buttoned down. One is, let's be candid about this. He carries this awful, awesome, wonderful burden of history and race. Mm-hmm. First black president.
Yep.
It's also true in our society, whether we want to believe it or not, that black men are looked at differently. And the last thing he wanted in his first 6 years was to show any anger, because then suddenly he'd be the angry black man.
Right.
He couldn't talk about race freely, because then his critics just had a field day with that. So, yes, I think that he is feeling looser and less burdened by those things than he was in his first 6 years.
I mean, talk about looser. Here he was with Mark Maron on WTF with Mark Maron. Went all the way to using the sort of great no of American racial language here, the N-word. Listeners, be forewarned, this clip contains that racial slur. But it's the President of the United States feeling the freedom to use it.
Racism, we are not cured of.
Clearly.
And it's not just a matter of it not being polite to say nigger in public. That's not the measure of whether racism still exists or not. It's not just a matter of overt discrimination. We have societies don't overnight completely erase everything that happened 200 to 300 years prior.
Michael Warren, here's a president feeling his oats, ready to let it rip more than we have maybe ever seen in his presidency. Where do you expect that to go in this final quarter of the game, as David Axelrod puts it?
Well, I'll dissent a little bit here and say that it does strike me less as actions based on a sort of liberated state that he feels himself in, but more a desperate state. If you look at the number of friends that the president has now compared to 6-7 years ago, there are fewer. He's got fewer Democrats in Congress here in Washington who supported his signature health care laws along with other signature domestic agenda items. If we see the trade agreement that just barely made it through Congress, a number of members of his own party had abandoned him and weren't supporting that. Looks like a maybe smaller number, but some Democrats will abandon him on this Iran deal. In a way, I see this new unleashed Obama as someone who's sort of desperate to find somebody to give him an applause. I think that's why you're seeing him sort of return in many ways to elements of his base. There's obviously African-American voters talking more about racial issues. Of course, those have actually been coming up in the news. So those have sort of met there. But also going on The Daily Show last night, he was among his people last night.
Yes.
When he came out there. And I think that that what you're seeing is more of someone looking for friends.
Yeah, here he was saying, John Stewart, stick around.
I'm issuing a new executive order that John Stewart cannot leave the show. It's being challenged in the courts.
Yes.
I have to say, for me, this is a states' rights issue.
Glenn Rush, plenty of love in that corner. How do you see this president beleaguered and therefore opening up, or empowered and therefore opening up?
I think he's both. You know, one of the things that's interesting is, you know, I wonder if the president's Justice Department would have authorized wiretaps on the Jon Stewart show as they did on the Associated Press. It is a very interesting, I think, over the course of the last 6.5 years that I've observed, very interesting watching his relationship with the press and his contempt for what he views as the mainstream press, which I think he shares with a lot of his conservative enemies. But, you know, I think in general, he is going back to his sort of his comfort zone. He's never left it. I mean, he doesn't sit down typically with interviewers who dissent or disagree with him. He's had a very narrow view at the press. In that sense, he isn't opening up at all. He isn't sort of exposing himself to a larger segment of public opinion. But I would disagree with the assertion before that he is somehow looking for friends. I think this guy has had a really successful second half of his second term. He started off horribly. After the Newtown shootings, he made a terrible strategic blunder by not pushing earlier for gun control. There were people in his administration who dissented on that. He was very slow on gay marriage. Again, I heard over and over from members of his staff that he moved too sluggishly on that. I think getting John Podesta, the former Clinton administration official who's currently working on her campaign, into the White House, he was a guy who stressed Obama's use of executive power, was a big deal, and he has turned the corner in that regard.
Cynthia, in a word, going on the ropes or on a roll here?
Oh, I think he's absolutely on the roll. I have no reason to think the president is beleaguered. Why would he be? So many of his signature programs have been accomplished, upheld, verified. He, as Glenn just said, has had a great second term.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Barack Obama in the home stretch of his presidency. More freewheeling, more outspoken, the full drama Obama. Before this hour is out, we will look at the Sandra Bland case in Texas, that dash cam, deeply unnerving video out today showing her interaction with the trooper there at the roadside in Texas, where she, the African-American woman, had driven from Chicago, headed for a new job there, ended up in jail after failing to use a turn signal for a lane change, and dead. Lots going on that front. We'll look at it in a moment. Glenn Thrush is with us to look at President Obama freewheeling on his way to the end of his presidency, chief political correspondent for Politico. Cynthia Tucker Haynes is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist formerly of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Michael Warren is here from the Weekly Standard. You can join us, too. He gave a little hint all the way back at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in April that maybe there was another approach coming.
After the midterm elections, my advisors asked me, Mr. President, do you have a bucket list? And I said, well, I have something that rhymes with bucket list. Take executive action on immigration? Bucket. New climate regulations? Bucket. It's the right thing to do.
A new tone there from the president, and maybe it's just kept right on rolling. Last night, Jon Stewart had fun with that, saying, oh boy, if you pull out all the stops, conservatives have their idea where you're headed.
You don't have that much time to take away Americans' guns, declare martial law, and put hardworking Americans in FEMA camps. If you're going to do that, You better get started. You better get started.
Okay, maybe that's not the agenda. Let's go to our listeners, Tom in Detroit, Michigan. Tom, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. What do you hear, sir?
Hi, Tom. You know, when I'm sitting here and all of these things popping in my head, he's like Old Man River. He just keeps on rolling along. And, I mean, as Muhammad Ali said, I'm floating like a butterfly and staying like a bee. And Sade said, he's a smooth operator.
Were you waiting, Tom? Were you thinking it's about time?
Well, you know what? He plays it cool. I mean, he's in his element. You know, like I said, you know, he was on the rope. He was roping. He was doping them on the rope and that kind of thing. So, you know, in terms of, like you said, he couldn't be come out in the first part of his administration. He couldn't come off as the angry black man, you know. What did he do? He just smiled, waved, and just kept on stepping. And, I mean, look, he got the Affordable Health Care Act through, you know, and a litany of other things. But you know what, man? I mean, I like what he's doing, and all I'm saying is, you know, brother man, keep on doing what you're doing and rolling that river, you know, smooth operating and floating like that butterfly and stinging like that bee.
Tom, thank you for your call bringing Sade back to us from Detroit there. Glenn Thrust, the president, told Jon Stewart last night, he suggested, well, you know, this was his plan all along. He planted those seeds, planted seeds patiently early on, and now they're coming to fruition. Michael Warren paints it as, well, you know, he's scraping through by the skin of his teeth here. What do you see? Long-term planning, a long game playing out here? Or a president looking to cement a legacy and a tone late in a cool presidency?
I actually sort of see two presidencies, two distinct presidencies, mm-hmm. maybe three. In the first 4 years, I mean, he was dealing with the financial crisis and he had the supermajorities in Congress, right? Which in a lot of ways were a huge burden. I think ironically, not having a lot of Democrats on the Hill has been enormously helpful to him. I like to say that I think the most valuable commodity in Washington is low expectations. And to a certain extent, having the attention on Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and not a lot of Democrats around to grouse has been really useful to him. So in the first term, he just had this massive list of deliverables based on that supermajority. And the whole first term was defined by that. The beginning of the second term was defined, I think, by the fact that he didn't quite know where to go. If you listen to his second inaugural, it was enormously ambitious. Mm-hmm. It was a great speech, short speech, extremely vague. I think really it was about halfway through that first year when he took it on the chin, particularly with the gun control stuff. I think history will judge that as a real Waterloo moment for him. That's when he decided to exercise executive power, got John Podesta on board, pushed the immigration executive order, and I think things have flowed from there.
Cynthia Tucker Haynes, I mean, you give us an explanation of why the president may have been more buttoned up earlier, but as an outspoken columnist and as an African-American, for that matter, did you feel impatience in the earlier years of his presidency? Did you want that amazing grace moment earlier on and more?
I didn't. What I became impatient with the president about was his expectation that his hard right critics in Congress were going to be persuaded to come around to his point of view. And I think that's another thing that marked the difference in his second term. I think that he spent an enormous amount of time, much more than he's given credit for in his first term, trying to persuade his critics to his point of view. I think many liberals were disappointed in the things he gave away politically in negotiating the Affordable Care Act and in negotiating other things, in trying to persuade some of his Republican critics to go along. He spent a lot of time with John Boehner trying to negotiate this grand deal over deficit reform. He could not get them on board. And I think by the time his midterm defeat, by the time his second term came along, he had given up on that. And he understood that he could not persuade his hard right critics to compromise. So he needed to turn to another strategy.
And he's had another strategy. He's had some wins with it, some with Republican cooperation, certainly, a vital support on trade. Now Republicans also talking about judicial reform, prison reform. Emily in New Orleans, thank you for calling. Emily, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a young person from New Orleans, and I grew up in a very conservative family. And I actually completed school in sociology, and I'm going on to complete my PhD now. And I would just like to say about Obama's presidency, I've really found that me learning since high school and my college degrees, my views have changed a lot. And then watching Obama's presidency as that went along, it's been very inspirational for me. And I think it's just really something that can't be understated for young people, how important this presidency is right now.
Emily, I appreciate your call. Let's hear a little bit more from the president. This was just last week, became the first sitting president to visit a federal prison. Of course, this is high on the agenda, the very crowded prisons, and Republicans, Democrats alike thinking again about that right now. President Obama met with inmates at a federal prison in Oklahoma, talked with the media, said at one point, you know, there, but for the grace of God, the implication Could have gone I, or many of us, if we'd made a misstep. Here's the president.
And we've got to be able to distinguish between dangerous individuals who need to be incapacitated and incarcerated versus young people who are in an environment in which they are adapting, but if given different opportunities, a different vision of life, could be thriving in the way we are. That's what strikes me. There but for the grace of God. And that, I think, is something that we all have to think about.
A sitting president standing in prison saying, if my own upbringing had been different, who knows? I could have been here. You could have been here. Debbie in Manchester, Tennessee. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you, Tom?
Okay. What do you think, Debbie?
Well, I initially called just in response to the last guest that spoke in the beginning, trying to point, saying that President Obama is desperate at this point, which is why he is being more bold. I disagree with that highly. I mean, what does he have to be desperate for? I think he has probably had all of these things on his agenda from the beginning, and he was always met with obstruction from the beginning. As far as getting cooperation from the hard right people in Congress, you know, I just don't think they were willing to compromise on anything, especially if he was for it.
Yeah, Debbie, we've got it. And now, as he's said in his correspondence dinner speech, Bucket, Michael Warren, would this have been a useful posture earlier in the Obama presidency? Might it have won him more Republican cooperation? Cynthia Tucker Haynes says perhaps he was naive to ever work for that. What if he had been bolder earlier? Or are you sympathetic to her view that as an African-American man, the first black president, he didn't have a choice of being bold earlier on? He would have been stereotyped as an angry black man and written off.
Well, I won't get into the sociology of it.
Well, why not?
Because I'm not a sociologist. But I will say that I think that that he didn't run as this sort of very bold, paradigm shifting, progressive liberal on a lot of these issues. He ran really quite vaguely in 2008 as a uniter. You know, I don't remember hearing anything in 2008 or in the 2012 reelection campaign about prison, going to prison, and talking about letting out certain violent criminals who have not been violent while in prison.
I think nonviolent has been the measure for those releases, hasn't it?
Well, at any rate, the president really didn't campaign on any of these on any of these issues, and so I think what you're seeing here is sort of a president who is unencumbered by elections, but also concerned about his own legacy. So when I mentioned that I think is desperate, I think he's looking around and seeing a Democratic Party that is in many ways decimated. There aren't you can just look at the 2016 presidential field and see that in terms of numbers, in terms of experience, there's sort of a dearth compared to the Republican field. And I think he's acting in this way to sort of cement a legacy that could be really damaged if he doesn't act in many ways unilaterally.
Carl, Glenn Thrush, so we've got accomplishments, you say, in the first part of this second term, as the second part in particular here. What about the rhetoric? How important is that for this president's legacy? Does he significantly change it by the way he speaks in the next 18 months?
Oh, yeah. And look, you can't view this now outside the context of the presidential race. And you can't look at it without the context of how Hillary Clinton is speaking. You know, to a certain extent, whatever Obama represents, he's sort of orphaned. The parties, the real energy in the party right now has been transferred to the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders wing, which is talking much more about income inequality. Hillary Clinton, I think, is focused much more on sort of the safer cultural issues. She's talking a good deal about women's economic equality, which is sort of her base. But, you know, when I was at her announcement on Roosevelt Island in May, the lines that got the biggest applause were LGBT rights and gay marriage. There was some discussion of Obama's legacy, but to a certain extent, the Democrats, both Sanders and Clinton, are kind of letting Obama do what Obama is going to do. Even on the Iran deal, Hillary was sort of bought into it, but she didn't give it an incredibly ringing endorsement. So what's interesting here is you have You know, when I started covering the White House in 2010, he was a titan on the national and international stage. He dominated absolutely everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's interesting to see him recede, and I think that's a big factor here. At his press conference last week, he did something I've never seen him do. He stopped, he got rid of his scripted list, and he started taking questions from the crowd. Unimaginable before, but that's the point. He is struggling right now, and if we're looking at any level of desperation in terms of defining legacy, it's that he wants to occupy the stage, and that stage is increasingly becoming crowded.
How does that play out for the Democrats who would like to succeed him in the White House? How does it play out for the Republicans, Glenn? If this president remains more outspoken, full drama Obama, for the last remaining chapter of his presidency?
I think that's a great question. Look, on Iran, he clearly, we found out in our reporting after the fact that, you know, he'd been communicating pretty closely with the Clinton camp on this. There'd been a great deal of communications between Jake Sullivan, a Clinton advisor, who worked on the initial Iran deal, and people like Ben Rhodes and Dennis McDonough in the White House. So there was a high level of coordination, so they didn't want to surprise Clinton. But we are seeing increasingly, in ways subtle and not subtle, Hillary Clinton differentiating herself from Obama. She's done so in the way that she talks about collaborating with Congress. And, interesting hearing what Cynthia said about how Obama wisened up and discovered that he couldn't collaborate with Republicans. It's very interesting to hear Hillary Clinton adopt a lot of the rhetoric that Obama used against Clinton in 2008, saying she will be more willing and able to build bridges.
John in Louisville, Kentucky. John, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I've got about six brief things that I think are troubling, and I haven't heard anyone really mention it. When Bush left office, there was $9 trillion in national debt. And since then, it's $18 trillion. It's doubled under a seven-year president. Doesn't make any sense. It's been doubled. That's just a fact. So also, campaign finance reform, why didn't he push for the fact that there's $1 billion to elect a guy? Like, you get two guys to each get $1 billion of super PAC money. Why wasn't there reform for that? What kind of president do you get when each one of them that's running has $1 billion to run that doesn't give a chance to the little guy to rise? Then income inequality, why isn't the minimum wage nationwide $18? It just should be that. And then he called Ed Snowden guilty. Guilty? He's a digital Paul Revere. The last couple things are the bailout. No bankers went to jail, and the money didn't go back to taxpayers. And he has advanced drone warfare more than Bush ever could have.
John, let me take it right there. That's quite a list already. Cynthia Tucker Haynes, there's a bill of dissatisfaction remaining with this president out of Louisville, Kentucky. Say what he wants. A lot of things John didn't get, and they're kind of all over the map in terms of political priorities there. What about the dissatisfied, even now, as the president speaks up in a more full-throated way?
Well, there are a couple of things on that list that I agree with wholeheartedly. One of which the president has no control over, and that's the amount of money that people can now spend for the presidency. That arises out of a Supreme Court decision that the president disagrees with, Citizens United. But on the point on drone warfare, I happen to agree, and I wish the president would back way off on drone warfare. He is much more committed to that, it's true, than George W. Bush was. And I think that's going to be a problem going forward because other countries will adopt that model, I fear.
Cynthia, you're our Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist here. What do you expect the president to say? What would you like him to say in the remaining time in office that maybe hasn't been articulated by this particular historical figure?
Well, actually, I very much like the course he's on. One of my great dissatisfactions with him from the beginning had been the fact that he didn't say anything about the war on drugs, the so-called war on drugs. He still really hasn't, but he is at least talking about prison reform, and I think that is a very important issue.
The president unplugged, going Bullworth, maybe his staff has talked about, and maybe we're seeing some of that now. Maybe we'll see more in the months ahead. Very interesting for this cool president. Cynthia Tucker Haynes in Mobile, Alabama. Thank you so much for being with us today, Cynthia.
Good to be here, Tom.
Michael Warren, staff writer at the Weekly Standard in Washington. Thank you for joining us today, Michael.
Thanks, Tom.
And Glenn Thrush, chief political correspondent for Politico. Thanks very much, Glenn.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to look at that case of Sandra Bland in Texas. She argued with a policeman, ended up cuffed and in jail, ended up dead in jail. What does the dash cam show us? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Texas police yesterday released dash cam video of a confrontation between a state trooper and motorist Sandra Bland.
I said, get out of the car.
Why am I being apprehended?
You just opened my car door. I'm giving you a lawful order. I'm going to drag you out of here.
So you're threatening to drag me out of my own car?
Get out of the car!
Didn't start as a confrontation. It started with Sandra Bland being pulled over for not using a turn signal when she changed lanes in Prairie View, Texas. She was ultimately ordered out of the car after refusing to put out a cigarette. She ended up face down on the ground in handcuffs. 3 days later, she was found hanging in her jail cell, dead. Texas Rangers and the FBI are investigating the cause of death. I incorrectly said earlier that it was the jailhouse video that may have been edited. Reports coming out now that the dash cam video may have been edited. We don't know, but it's being looked into right now. You can join us. Have you listened to this tape? What happened here? With me now from New York is Gloria Brown Marshall, associate professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Professor, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
This is kind of an amazing interaction that goes from something that seems so minor to something that seems so fraught so quickly. I want to listen to just a little bit more and talk it through with you. We really need your perspective here. Here's some more where Texas State Trooper Brian Encinia talks with Sandra Bland after he has pulled her car over, saying that she hadn't used a turn signal when she changed lanes.
You okay?
I'm waiting on you. This is your job. I'm waiting on you. What do you want me to do?
Oh, you seem very irritated.
I am. I really am. But I feel like this cop is what I'm getting a ticket for. I was getting out of your way. You were speeding up, tailing me. So I move over, and you stop me. So, yeah, I am a little irritated, but that doesn't stop you from giving me a ticket.
She says, you pulled up on my tail. I looked like I needed to get out of your way. I pull over. Now you're giving me a ticket. Why? Gloria Marshall Brown, I'm sure you've listened to this carefully, maybe been able to watch it as well. We're going to go through a lot of sound here, but help frame this up for us. This encounter at the roadside, a woman who's driven down from Chicago, looking to go back to her alma mater and a job there in Texas maybe. What do you see unfolding here?
I see an officer in a small town seeing an out-of-state license plate and doing some profiling. And as she pointed out, that she moved over and changed lanes. He says that he's pulling over because she didn't use a signal. How many people would be pulled over every single day for not or inadvertently or not using a signal to change lanes on a street where there's not a lot of traffic? And then she explained herself, she was trying to get out of his way. So we can see he was intent on having this interaction with her anyway and finding out why she was in his town probably.
And then it gets testier. In a hurry, here's the state trooper telling her to get out of her car. Not just that, put out the cigarette.
You mind putting out your cigarette, please? Don't mind.
I'm in my car, but I have to put out my cigarette.
Well, you can step on out now.
I don't have to step out of my car.
Step out of the car.
Okay, Gloria Brown Marshall, again, we need perspective here. An officer has pulled someone over, you or me or somebody else, for a traffic violation, apparently. You're smoking a cigarette. The officer says, please put the cigarette out. She says, well, I don't have to. I'm in my car. Who's right?
Well, let's put it in this light. You just said an officer pulls over you or me. I don't think an officer would have told you, if you were smoking, to put your cigarette out. Because being a white male, I don't think an officer would have done that. So it also depends on the neighborhood. But because we're talking about an African-American female, mm-hmm. we have a power dynamic in which he believes he can tell her to do that. There is nothing that says that she does not have a right to have a cigarette while she's being, you know, asked these questions. So there's no, you know, right for him to say, put out the cigarette. And there's nothing that she's done in violation of the law for smoking the cigarette.
So I don't want to move away from the racial dynamic here for a moment or deny it in any way. But just in legal terms. She says, you know, why do I have to put out my cigarette? You're saying she's right.
I'm saying that she's smoking a cigarette. Is the cigarette interacting with his ability to ask her questions? Is the cigarette preventing her from handing him a license if he asks for that license? No. So I don't see why it would be illegal for her to smoke a cigarette during this interaction. And once again, I don't think he would ask a white male, especially, especially an upper-class white male in an upper-class neighborhood, but I don't think he would ask a white male to put out the cigarette.
Period, you say. Then he asked her to step out of the car. Now, her alleged offense is not using a turn signal. What about this action? She says, you know, I don't have to step out of my car. At that point, who's technically right under the law?
Well, she does not have to step out of the car under the law. And this is the thing. We tell people to know their rights. And as a constitutional law professor at John Jay College, I talk to my students all the time about knowing their rights. But I also want them to come back from a police interaction alive. So she had the right to stay in the car because there was nothing that he had said or done that indicates that she was violent, to indicate that she had a weapon, that this interaction should escalate to the point where she needs to be taken out of the car. However, because we want our people to come home alive, and in the black community, unfortunately, we have to tell our people, young, old, and everyone else, to cooperate with police, even with what they're asking for is not within their right to receive.
Now, at this point in the dash cam video and audio, things really begin to escalate. As he insists on this, she's reading him. I mean, just listening, just as an observer, it looks to me like she's not happy. She can see he's not happy. She doesn't want to get out of that car. Here's the interaction.
Get out of the car.
You know that you didn't have enough 98.
Get out of the car now.
Why am I being apprehended? You're trying to give me a ticket for your
failure? I said get out of the car.
Why am I being apprehended?
You I'm giving you a lawful order. I'm going to drag you out of here.
So you're going to drag me out of my own car?
Get out of the car.
And then you
I will light
me?
You up. Get out.
Wow.
Now.
Wow.
Get out of the car.
Ready for a failure to signal. You're doing all of this for
get
a
over there.
Professor Brown Marshall at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Give us some analysis of this police-civilian interaction.
Well, once again, we have a power dynamic. We have someone who is supposed to protect and serve. He believes probably, if my assumption is right, that he was profiling her license in the first place, that he can find maybe some drugs in the car. Or he wants the power dynamic to show he's boss. He might have had a bad day with his wife. Who knows? But he's taking it out on her because he feels he can. And he feels he can in a power position. He's got the taser, and he's got it at eye level. He's putting a taser in her face, something that could cause irreparable harm. That is what he's doing. And he is not going to be deterred in the use of his power. And we see that when he begins to drag her out. She's asking him very commonsensical questions. Why are you doing this when all you said I did was not use my turn signal? What has that got to do with leaving my car?
Is the officer obligated to explain why he wants her to come out of the car or not?
Yes, the officer is supposed to give some explanation of what the officer wants from the civilian. You know, I want you to leave the car because, or if you know, would you mind stepping out of your car? I mean, these things have to, you know, based on his training and based on what police policy is, it's supposed to be an explanation of to the civilian of police behavior. But it's not warranted here in his mind because she's not a civilian he has to respect. On the other hand, civilians are told that even if what the officer is asking for is unreasonable, you should comply and then complain later.
He says, I will light you up, apparently pointing this stun gun at her. What about that in terms of procedure? Do you threaten someone sitting in their car?
It's so far beyond anything a police officer should be allowed to do. And you think about this. With the dash cam, this is what, if that dash cam is edited, this is what we're being allowed to see. Because when we look at that dash cam and find her on the ground later on and all these horrible things, it just makes me wonder if this is what he's doing in broad daylight, what were they doing to her in that jail cell?
Barry in Richmond, Kentucky. Barry, thanks for calling. What do you think?
Yes, sir. I believe that's a game of expectations. We expect certain morals from the officer and also the driver. When the officer approaches you, he is pumped up with adrenaline because he doesn't know what's inside the car besides seeing the driver. Now, the driver could have been more polite. Suppose if I was pulled over, I would say, sorry, officer, what did I do wrong? And if he asks me to get out of the car, I certainly will. It's very unfortunate that this matter has escalated to this level. And I really feel sorry that lady passed away. And there may be something more to it than what it's all reported. But bottom line is, if the officer says, do something, I believe it's on us to do whatever he asks and then take it to court later on.
Barry, what if Sandra Bland is sitting in that car feeling, look, all I did was pull over to get out of a policeman's way? What if she's sitting there feeling picked on? I don't know. What if she's thinking about all the incidents we've seen, very public incidents of overzealous, shall we say, policing in the last year, and thinking, you know what, I'm not going to take this. Is there a place for that?
Yeah, not really. If the officer pulls over Sandra Bland, she needs to get out of the car. I mean, then instead of asking all these questions the way she has, it will irritate the officer, which we don't want to do, because they're already in pumped up adrenaline, they're afraid, and they're taking their life, not knowing what.
I mean, how afraid should he be of a single woman driving down the street? Not all she did was not use a turn. It's not like she's got guns hanging out the window or she's been acting. You know, let's listen. It goes, Barry, thank you for your call. It goes on. The trooper tells Sandra Bland she's under arrest after stopping her.
What are you,
put your hands behind your back and turn
arrested?
Around. Turn around.
Why can't you tell
I'm
me
I'm giving you a lawful order. I will tell you.
Why am I being arrested?
Turn
why
around.
Why won't you tell me that part?
I'm giving you a lawful order. Turn around.
Why will you not
you
tell me
you are
what's
not
going
complying.
On? I'm not complying because you just pulled me out of my car.
Turn around.
Okay, I've got here the latest coming out from the Texas Department of Public Safety saying the video was not edited. Was not edited, they are saying. But just listening to it as it is, she says, why am I being arrested? Is that a legitimate question in this case, Gloria?
It is very much a legitimate question. Why am I being asked to get out of the car? Why am I being arrested? Because you're being arrested on for this, disorderly conduct, for this, something. The officer, we're not in a police state where someone, because they have a badge and they work for whatever state, local, or federal government, can just take a civilian, put handcuffs on them, and take them away without telling them why. And this is what we're allowing, this double standard. And when, if they come for me today, they'll come for you tomorrow. If they're able to do this to black women in a small town traveling alone, not tell her why she's being placed in handcuffs, please, people need to understand they'll be doing this to you tomorrow. There is no nice way to put it, to say, yes, you have to do whatever an officer says without explanation, and then just suffer the consequences later. This is not the kind of country I think we believe we live in.
She ends up on the ground. She knows that a traffic signal that she didn't use, a turn signal here, is part of the deal. Things get really, really ugly then. We can't see it all, but we can hear a lot.
False traffic signal.
You are
false
yanking around. When you pull away from me, you're resisting arrest.
This makes you feel real good, don't it? A female for a traffic signal.
I got it.
For a traffic signal. I know that makes you feel good, officer.
Go ahead, take care of yourself.
I know it makes you feel real good. You're a real man now. You just slammed me, knocked my head in the ground. I got epilepsy.
I've got epilepsy, she says, and the officer responds, good. Let's go to Sean in New Orleans, Louisiana. Sean, you're on the air.
I just think that the officer was way out of bounds. He went overboard with it, and I didn't think the young lady deserved that, because she has the right to ask questions when she want to ask questions about what she's being stopped for and what she's being arrested for. And the officer, he was obviously ticked off from Jump Street, and anybody would be irritated behind not using a signal light. And as far as them finding her hung in the cell, it's just gonna be like all the other cases, the Eric Gardner and all those. Nothing will never come of it.
Well,
that's just my opinion.
Sean, I appreciate you sharing your opinion with us. We'll see what happens on that front. It's being looked into now. Of course, suicide is the word that the jailhouse officials originally have given to the world here. And yes, there were Facebook posts by Sandra Bland some time ago saying she was depressed and so on. But who wouldn't be upset after an interaction like that on the road? I'm not saying it's a reason to kill oneself, but that's pretty upsetting stuff. Bob in Buffalo, New York. Bob, you're on the air.
Yeah, my question basically is, was the request either reasonable or legal? And do we really expect people to do anything that an officer tells you to do?
You mean the request to put the cigarette out, Bob? Put the cigarette out, that?
all the requests.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "I'm giving you a lawful order." Was that order lawful or reasonable?
Gloria?
The order of a police officer, even if it's the arrest is unreasonable, and this is the issue we had in the Eric Garner case, that he was supposed to allow himself to be arrested on the command of the officer, even if that arrest is unreasonable. This is what we're dealing with, the power of a law enforcement agent to abuse their power, and then we have to then submit to that abuse of power and then try to bring charges later against that officer. This is the system we have in place, and that's why the criminal system is broken. The criminal justice system is not only broken, it's being used as a tool to oppress people like Sandra Bland, like Eric Garner, and many others. And as the caller said, in many instances, there is no consequence to the officer outside of a stained reputation.
I don't know what option she had here. I mean, he could have been more chill. Maybe he had concerns that we can't see somehow on this dash cam. But she, you know, I mean, if she had just stayed in the car, he was prepared to apparently to tase her when she expressed her dissatisfaction. It just got more escalated. So what can she do as a citizen who doesn't feel she's being treated right? If she stays in, she gets tased. She gets out. She's on the ground and cuffed and head against the ground, she says.
Well, we have to really stop looking at this in isolated incidents, and we want to because, mm-hmm. you know, that makes it better. I guess it doesn't make it as horrific. This has been a horrible year for African Americans, a horrible year. And people keep looking at these incidents from Michael Brown to all the Walter Scott shot in the back. Maybe she was afraid of being shot in the back like Walter Scott. Who knows? But this has been a horrendous year. Many people are sitting back looking at this saying, well, maybe if she had done this, maybe. When are we going to stop and say the police department has gotten so far out of hand when it comes to abusing people's constitutional rights, we've got to do something about it sooner rather than later?
Well, that question is on the table right here. Gloria Brown Marshall, associate professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, joining us today from New York. It's always good to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Say your piece. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.